original deadline, so we shift to comparative effectiveness studies. Dr. Rita Redbear from San Francisco.
Thank you very much, and again, thank the organizers for inviting me to this meeting. And my topic is comparative effectiveness studies, how they may help decision makers and support utilization in clinical practice. I have no conflicts. I'm a member of the FDA device panel. So I think, you know, just to define the goals of comparative effectiveness, the goals are, in my opinion, and as defined by the Institute of Medicine, to compare new treatments to currently available treatments and to help us weigh the benefits and risks of alternatives. And so I think if you just take those goals, you know, certainly comparative effectiveness is essential to help inform decision makers as well as clinicians, because we're faced every day in our office with the choice of what is the right what therapy is appropriate, and is a new therapy better than existing therapies. I added that I think it's helpful to be specific, because as we didn't have time to get into a lot here, but risks and benefits are often different for women than they are for men. In general, women will have more bleeding and more procedural morbidity, so it's particularly true for devices or for drugs that have bleeding. And women tend to be older when they have heart disease, and so often have more comorbidities. And so I think it's important in randomized trials as well as in registries to be able to look at the data in a sex-specific way and also age-specific way. So I think, you know, generally it's very helpful to have comparative effectiveness studies in order to inform decision-making and inform clinical use. And I think that was recognized certainly in the United States in the Affordable Care Act, which put $1 billion into the PCORI, the Patient-Centered Outcomes Research Unit, which is charged with looking at comparative effectiveness. I would note that there was a lot of controversy in starting, and the definition of comparative effectiveness was strictly clinical effectiveness, which is, you know, very important, and I don't think you can talk about anything else until you have talked about clinical effectiveness, because if there isn't clinical effectiveness, there isn't any, I think, point in going on to other things. But they were specifically prescribed from discussing cost effectiveness, and in addition, the PCORI, at least in the U.S., was told that there would be no direct impact on coverage decisions, which, of course, is different, I think, than in a lot of European countries. NICE is one example in Britain, and as well as others, where there is a clear relationship between the technology assessment and risks and benefits and coverage decisions. And one could say that that would make some sense to use the, you know, whether you know if a new treatment is better or not, to help inform how you use it and what the coverage is. When is comparative effectiveness not possible? So I would say it's not possible if there are no current existing treatments for the condition. So if you have a disease that we don't have any current treatments for, then obviously it's going to be hard to have a control group. But I think that is a rare case, and that for most diseases there is conventional medical therapy, and that should certainly be in the control arm. And then I just wanted to spend a few minutes talking about what is the current state of comparative effectiveness data, and in particular focus on devices, because that has been myself and my colleagues' area of research for the last few years. So this is a study that we published in JAMA a few years ago, looking at pre-market approvals for cardiovascular devices. I think perhaps everyone knows, but I'll just point out that pre-market approval is the most stringent approval process for the FDA. It is required for novel or high-risk devices, and it's used in a very small percentage of devices. Only less than 1% of all devices approved by the FDA annually go through a pre-market approval process. It is the only process through the FDA that requires clinical trial data. The other processes, general and special controls, and 510K don't require clinical trial data, although it may sometimes be considered. So in the first study, we looked at all of the high-risk devices that were approved by the FDA between 2000 and 2007, and we looked specifically at the type of studies that were were submitted to the FDA in support of approval of high-risk devices. And these were only approved high-risk devices because we did this using the publicly available data from the FDA, and devices that are not approved are not posted on the website. So looking at approved devices, there were 78 Class 3 devices approved in this eight-year period. Less than one-third of them were approved on the basis of randomized control trials. And if you look, and we talked already a lot in detail about the issues of blinding, and I certainly agree with Bill that we are underutilizing sham controls in device trials, but less than 5% of the studies that were used for approval for these high-risk devices were blinded and confirmatory trials. And I just would add, in terms of the sham controls and the issue that Bill mentioned about ethical considerations, but I think there are ethical considerations to having a device that does not have a sham control, because then you're talking about implanting a device and you don't know if the device is effective or if it was actually just the procedure that is effective. For example, taking a non-cardiac example, a kyphoplasty, a procedure for low back pain and spinal stenosis, has been used for years. It's actually still being used. But in two randomized controlled trials, both, I would say, done outside the U.S., published in the New England Journal a few years ago, that used a sham control, there was no benefit. They had subjective endpoints. They were both looking at pain relief, and the pain relief was equal for the group that got the sham procedure as the group that got the actual procedure. And now, to use the cardiac example, I would just point out that PCI has never been studied compared to medical therapy in a sham control arm, so we really don't know if the subjective pain relief that's seen for stable coronary disease in the PCI versus medical therapy arm is due to getting that little piece of mesh in your artery, or whether it's actually just having a procedure and feeling that your symptoms got better for a while after a procedure. And we know that those differences in symptoms have all tended to disappear over time in the PCI versus medical therapy trials. Going on, this was more of the analysis published in JAMA, and it just shows that about a third of the pre-market approvals were done on the basis of randomized studies. Even fewer were blinded. About one-third were done on the basis of studies that did not have any U.S. centers. In addition, there were, although the reviewer said, what do you mean more than one primary endpoint? But it actually was fairly common to have more than one endpoint listed as a primary endpoint. 23% of the pre-market approvals were done using post hoc analysis as the approval decision, and 23% had an endpoint using retrospective controls. We then went further, and this was just published a few weeks ago in JAMA, where we looked specifically at what were the types of controls used for these same high-risk studies. This, as you can see, we extended the analysis now from 2000 to the end of 2011. So this was 12 years worth of high-risk approvals, high-risk devices approved by pre-market approval. And we specifically looked at how frequently do we get comparative effectiveness data for devices, because clearly I think we've indicated in the U.S. that comparative effectiveness data is important when for decision makers as well as clinicians. And so what we've found is that less than half, only 40% of all cardiovascular premarket approvals include an active comparator. 13% of these use historical controls, which means controls from a study that was previously done. So your study just got the new device, but then the control group was from some other study done previously. 25% used objective performance criteria, which doesn't have a control group. You just say we're going to say have successful implantation in 70% of their patients, and that would be the performance goal. And 22% were approved on the basis of studies that had no form of control. So they mentioned no objective performance criteria and had no control group. And so I would conclude on the basis of this analysis, at any rate, that if we are going to be using comparative effectiveness to inform decision makers and as well as to help clinicians, that we need to have more rigorous standards for comparative effectiveness studies for cardiac devices. We talked a little bit about registries, and certainly I think there is a role for registries, particularly a lot of the post-approval studies are registries. I would point out an obvious deficiency or problem with registries, besides the selection bias that we've already talked about, is that they don't have a control group. And so when you're talking about devices, I think it makes it even more important that your pre-market approval was based on a well-done, high-quality, randomized control trial. Because as much as we talk about the importance of post-approval studies, there have been no devices that have had their approval rescinded on the basis of post-approval data. So we're really making the decision, it seems, to approve that high-risk implanted device on the basis of that pre-market study, which, as I just showed you, is often not a randomized control study and very infrequently is a blinded study. The registries do have an important role in telling us how the devices are performing in the real-world populations, but they're not going to tell us how they perform compared to a control group. And as has been mentioned, some of the examples recently, our percutaneous aortic valves was approved with a joint FDA-CMS effort and a simultaneous registry that's being run by the American College of Cardiology and the Society of Thoracic Surgeons. And ICDs were approved and mandated to have the ICD registry at the time. Although, as I said, it has not actually been used to go back and modify any kind of coverage criteria. And so I would just pose the question for discussion, is our current standard sufficient to inform clinical practice and decision makers? Thank you.